Welcome to the next edition of Micro Brew. My name is J.R. Radcliffe. Oh man, my voice is not what it normally sounds like. As I'm sure you know, if you listen to our podcast, been under the weather, way under the weather for a week. Actually, a little bit out of the woods at this point. So forgive the scratchiness. Fortunately, on the other line, I've got Kurt Hoag, Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And he sounds great. And furthermore, you'll have more of me at the back end of this episode that sounds great as well, because I've got two interviews lined up for you. Figured you'd want to hear more of the normal voice than this voice. So had some stuff pre-recorded, including a conversation with Stephen Watson. You may know him on the Bally Sports Wisconsin broadcast. He's a new addition to the pregame and postgame show. Caught up with him. If you live in Milwaukee, you know him from WISN, his work at Channel 12 for a long time. He's not from Milwaukee, so he's got kind of an interesting story of getting into sports and getting into this new position at Bally. So we definitely, I really had a good time chatting with him. And then a name I know you know is Ricky Weeks, former Brewers second baseman. He's now in the organization as a sort of an instructor now at the minor league level, moving around. I asked him about some of his memories as a Brewers player, his new job, some Prince Fielder memories, because Prince Fielder is going to be coming back for the Walk of Fame induction here in early August. So lots of great stuff on the podcast for you this week. Only three games, but all wins, the Milwaukee Brewers. Kurt, you said this on the last episode. You said, well, the Colorado Rockies, that could be a sweep, a four-game sweep, and I kind of let it slide because, okay, whatever. Well, now they're in position with this Monday wraparound to actually sweep the Colorado Rockies. It's good. The Rockies are not a good team, but it's something. Oh, off the top, what is your evaluation of these first three games back? Can we get excited about it, or do you have to just really, really hammer that caveat that it's still just the Colorado Rockies?
It feels so good to be so right, JR.
You are right.
It is a sweet taste of victory. Although they do need to win one more still for me to be technically correct. But I am feeling pretty good right about now.
So just in general, we saw, I would classify the Friday night game as frustrating because the Brewers, they do win it in the 13th on a Luis Urias walk-off, but there was a lot of suffering offensively in that game. They do bust out the bats on Saturday, and then Sunday they also bust out the bats. Pitching wasn't great. It definitely had made it perhaps a little more exciting than I'm sure Brewers fans would like it to be, but it was an exciting game. Exciting finish, big double by Andrew McCutchen. And then Hunter Renfroe has homered. He's homered in all three of these games. We talked about the offensive MVP last week, if Jace Peterson was the guy or who we would turn to. You know, I'm starting to think it's got to be Hunter Renfroe. When he's in the lineup, they're just a different team. He's come off a couple injuries, and when he's there, and on defense too, we talked about that, he's really valuable to them, and he bombs away, you know, the down-to-the-last-strike home run on Friday night that kept the game going was a big one. But Hunter Renfroe, man, new Brewers team MVP, non-Burns edition, new Brewers team MVP. What do you think?
I think I can get behind that. I mean, one of the other guys, Jace Peterson's hurt right now. That was in that discussion. Renfroe's the only guy slugging over 500. And he's, after today, you know, notably over 500. He's got 16 bombs in 62 games. So pretty much whenever he's been healthy, outside of, I think, of a bit of a slow start there, he's been producing, and it's kind of an element that they just don't have. I mean, Willie Adames has, you know, he's got plenty of power. He's got 20 homers, might break the franchise record for shortstop homers in a season. But Renfroe's just a different level of raw power. And that's been his MO his entire career, you know, even as a prospect, as a collegiate player, teammate with Brandon Woodruff at Mississippi State. Like, this is who he is. And when he's going, it can legitimately carry an offense, and it kind of did this series.
You know, Kurt, we both have covered high school sports, and we take no pleasure in, both of us have covered Oak Creek High School, Alex Benelis, the Milwaukee native who was traded as part of that deal to get Renfroe just before the lockout kicked in with the Red Sox. We take no pleasure in Alex Benelis struggling at all. We root for the guy, to be quite honest. It's been a slow start for him. It hasn't been a huge sample or anything, but once he got promoted to AA, wasn't maybe quite the same numbers that you were seeing from him out of high A. And so you look at that trade right now that David Stearns made, and it's looking pretty good. Now it's too early to evaluate. The Eric Lauer trade has taught us the ebbs and flows of the Trent Grisham, Eric Lauer, Luis Urias trade has told us he can't evaluate really at any point in the first year or two, but it's looking like this might be yet again a really necessary thing that David Stearns did. And I mean, I just wonder offensively, like, they just don't have many weapons right now. So offensively, if they didn't have him, I don't know where they'd be. It feels like that's a really big thing for them. overall, as you see these three Rockies games, does it feel like there's another level offensively that maybe they have busted out the bats a little bit? Or again, is it just Rockies pitching staff isn't very good? Is that the only thing that you can say coming through these three games?
Well, to touch on that trade really quickly, one of the big things is they got off the Jackie Bradley Jr. contract, who he's been, you know, bad again this year. He has a 5.55 OPS, which is better than it was last year, but not by much. So, you know, you figured kind of to get off that contract, you'd have to attach a mid-level prospect like Benellis anyway. And the Brewers added, I think, David Hamilton as well, who steals a lot of bases. But then to get Hunter Renfroe back at a position where you absolutely needed a guy, under the radar, huge move from the Brewers offseason. And it's always interesting, kind of, you know, with, I feel like we've had to do this with the Reds and the Pirates as well, the other teams the Brewers have kind of beat up on. The Rockies away from home are never a good team. I think there is a rhyme or reason to it. It's difficult to adjust from playing at Coors to all of a sudden playing at a completely different elevation. It's like the ball moves completely differently, and it's just not what you're used to. So I don't want to make any sweeping statements about how much better this team is after winning three games, but the three wins count, and the Cardinals have lost two games in that stretch, and that counts. So I think that's that's the takeaway from it, is they gained two games in the standings.
The Colorado Rockies have 15 wins away from Coors Field this year. That is...
seems bad.
Oh,
that seems not good. Almost August.
Yeah, I don't even know how that's possible. I mean, the Tigers only have 15 wins away from Comerica Park, so I guess it's not, like, incomprehensible. But
they do this, like, even the years where they're good, they're not a good road team. They just, I think it was either last year or 2 years ago, historically bad on the road. But the wins count. You still got to beat them.
The Brewers now, by comparison, as a road team, have almost double the number of wins the Rockies have. They have 29 and 24. All right, we saw Josh Hader. We saw him twice, and there was one save that I would say was pretty good on Friday, or I shouldn't say save, but an appearance as part of that 13-inning game. And then he appeared again on Sunday. He did give up a run. He got a couple strikeouts, but then a triple and a couple, another hard-hit ball against him. Now, he does lock down the save. The Brewers win that game 10-9. But I don't know how you evaluate that. Obviously, coming off of that really shaky end of the first half of the season, you were hoping to see Josh Hader figure it out a little bit and really start to dominate in the second half. I don't know if we've seen that, but you've gotten only, I think, 7 swings and misses over a course of 9 batters. That's a little bit light for what we've come to expect out of Josh Hader. How do you evaluate what you saw out of him in these two appearances?
Yeah, he's not all the way back yet. It's trending in the right direction. I mean, the run that scored today, it did come in on the flare single with 2 outs there, but I believe it was Jonathan Daza. So a little bit out of his control there. I mean, he did get up the really hard hit ball before that, but it's been sort of a mixed bag in those two outings for him, but better than what we saw previously, where it seemed like guys were putting really, really good swings on his fastball consistently, and he had a tough time, finding the slider too. So, a little more of the usual Josh Hader. The guy in front of him, Devin Williams, continues to absolutely shove, but Hader's still trying to find it out as the bullpen situation's a little bit murky for the crew.
Speaking of dominant left-handers, or capable of being dominant left-handers, that's Aaron Ashby. 5-year deal to stay in Milwaukee. That was announced on Saturday. $25 million deal. They buy out all of his arbitration. It's a very similar deal to what the Brewers did in 2020 with Freddie Peralta, really investing big in their young, promising arms. Peralta was 23 at the time, and Ashby's 24, so it's right about the same time period. A vote of confidence, certainly, in how the Brewers view him. I mean, the cynic in you might say, well, he's a little more tradable now because he's a guy who comes with some cost certainty. I don't think that's what the Brewers expect to do, but this was a pretty eye-opening move. Good for Aaron Ashby, who's excited to outperform the contract. You know, that's what you'll hear when someone signs a contract this early on. Okay, they probably the Brewers are probably going to come out ahead on that, and Aaron Ashby hopes so, because that means he stays in the big leagues and performs. Give me your thoughts on this one.
Yeah, that is how these early in the career contracts often go, because the player's getting the guaranteed money as opposed to playing year to year, and they can get cut at any point and no guaranteed salaries. They take the guaranteed money, and oh boy, JR, let me tell you, I would not mind $20 million guaranteed in my life over the next 5 years. And that's kind of how Aaron Ashby was, you know, that's kind of how he was going about his day on Saturday. He was, you know, talking to guys in the clubhouse and just seemed very grateful and very at ease to have that peace of mind. And he also acknowledged that, you know, maybe he's given up money on the back end, but as he said, you know, we don't have a fortune teller around here. It'd be great if we did, but we don't. So I have no idea, you know, if I'm going to be a superstar by that point, if he is a superstar by the time he would have hit free agency at 6 years of service time, he's going to be giving up a fair amount of money. The Brewers have him for the next, or club options, for what would be his first 2 years of free agency for, I think, like a total of $26 million. And I'm sure him and the Brewers would both like to think that he'll be, you know, at that point, you know, age 30, kind of in his peak, would be worth more than $13 million a year. But that's, again, that's how these transactions work. And talking to David Stearns yesterday, you get the message and the vibe that those two club option years are, you know, that the Brewers needed those in order to make the deal, because that's sort of the whole perk of it. They get him for his current club control and the ability to get him a little beyond that while also getting a little bit of a discount. So we'll see if it ends up being a complete steal. I have a feeling it might look sort of like the Freddie Peralta deal in a couple of years when you're looking at how much money the Brewers kind of saved on the guy. But like I said, $20 million, Ashby guaranteed, is set for life.
Yeah, I said 20.5 million dollars. Not bad. And you mentioned Freddie Peralta. There was some good news on that front. He's out on a rehab assignment. Actually made his first rehab appearance with Nashville much earlier than I guess I was expecting, on Sunday. So there's some promise that he'll be back very soon. That's great news for the Brewers. The bad news, though, Jace Peterson, we mentioned that at the outset, he is going to be gone for a significant amount of time. He does have an elbow issue. It is the UCL. That's a bad sign. And that could be optimistically late August, maybe more pessimistically not this year or September at best. So that's a loss that I don't think will register with most everyone. I think even people who are really high on who really follow the Brewers and understand how valuable he's been, I think that's a little bit, it's a little relational. Like, he's really been valuable because the Brewers haven't had a lot of valuable offensive guys. I think Jace Peterson is ideally the guy that you have on a team that already has a really qualified lineup, and then he's kind of the guy that fills in. He plays great defense. It's one of the reasons why his WAR has been so high, both at Baseball Reference and Fangraphs, relative to others in the offense. You know, I still don't think people are going to really worry about what the team looks like without him, but that is a pretty big hole to fill. He's been a high performer for them, particularly at third base on offense, but especially on defense. So what do you think the repercussions are going to be without Jace Peterson available?
Yeah, not only a high performer, but kind of, you know, a critical roster piece when you look at the roster construction as well. Like, they don't have a lot of left-handed bats outside of, you know, kind of the regulars in Telez and whatnot. So they'll miss that coming off the bench as well, you know, when he's not starting. I do think it's going to come down to how Luis Urias ends up playing. They do have a capable fill-in, you know, at third base, which is where Peterson, before some of the injuries, he was getting a lot of time in the outfield after the injuries. But before the injuries, playing a ton at third base, playing a great third base. I mean, 114 OPS plus, career high homers, you know, 10 steals. He's been great on the bases. Just great, a great all around season for him. So it's a tough loss. Craig Counsell called it a big loss yesterday, acknowledging the magnitude of it. Like I said, I do think they have a capable replacement in Luis Urias, at least offensively. You know, shouldn't lose too much there. Although I do think the defensive drop off is somewhat notable there. We were kind of already looking at third base JR as like a sneaky upgrade spot, and I wonder now if it's even more of an upgrade spot.
Yeah, I think it's a big concern. Center field is going to be the top spot everyone expects them to upgrade at, but with the trade deadline close. I want to ask you more about Luis Urias, and I don't want to discount that he had a very good week. He struggled for the most of Friday's game, but then he gets the walk-off single. He gets on base multiple times, both Saturday and Sunday. I mean, he did okay, but I don't know if I personally, having seen him all this year, could trust that that's a guy that you can rely on at third base, certainly defensively. Offensively, too, though, I don't know if he's really the guy, you know, and you like a little bit of versatility with him. He can play a couple different infield spots. And, you know, there's a ceiling there still that I think, you know, he's young enough that you can kind of dream out what he's ultimately going to be doing. I don't know this year that he's capable enough of carrying this team from a corner infield spot. So I think that is an area where you have to look at an upgrade. I think it is more urgent now if you don't expect to have Jace Peterson back for the bulk, if any, of the remaining season and the postseason. So, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong. Tell me if I'm just not seeing something in the numbers or seeing something with my eye test watching him play defense at third base. But again, this was a good weekend for him. But overall, I guess I haven't been impressed enough to say that I think that's a guy they need to put at third base and be their one of their corner infielders for this, you know, for this playoff run.
They're very clearly committed to Urias long term. I mean, they're playing him every day. Kind of contrast it with, you know, how they've played Castanheira, another young guy who, you know, could be a part of their future and is currently in AAA. So they're committed to Urias, but I don't know if they would not be better off, you know, finding a third baseman, an everyday third baseman, or a versatile guy who can play third base. And that doesn't mean Urias isn't playing a significant amount of time. You can move him around. He can play, you know, three infield spots. You have a DH. He's certainly capable with the bat. I do wonder if that is one of these spots to upgrade. I mean, you mentioned center field there, and there's just not a ton of tantalizing options in center field. Brian Reynolds doesn't seem like he's going to be traded, at least not from, you know, what you've seen around. And what I've heard is the Pirates seem to be interested on keeping him. And Ramon Laureano is a name out there, but yeah, just not a ton of center field options. And if you don't get the right deal, or none of them, you know, are enough of an upgrade over Taylor and Davis, I don't know what you do there. So maybe third base has kind of gone from like being a sneaky under the radar spot, but might have a spot they'll upgrade to, like, I kind of expect it almost at this point.
Yeah, Tyrone Taylor, who came back, he had a big home run this weekend. He can play center field. He's available to do that. McCutcheon in a pinch. I know that's not a preferred situation, but then you have Jonathan Davis as kind of the defensive option. They could get away with it. You know, Cedric Mullins for the Baltimore might have been a sneaky possibility, but now he's, you know, the Baltimore Orioles are 500. They're in a playoff chase pretty much. So I don't know if that's going to happen in addition to Reynolds. So I agree with you. I think they might have a better shot looking elsewhere. My voice is fading, Kurt. I can feel it going. So let's move into three up, three down.
Let's do it.
All right, let's start with the first part of the week, the All-Star game. We haven't even mentioned that. Devin Williams gets into the game, his first All-Star appearance. He works a scoreless inning, gives up a one out single to I'm drawing a blank. Jose Trevino, right? The Yankees catcher, but does get a strikeout, three outs. Nicely done. Congratulations to Devin Williams, first time All-Star. But the National League does not win for the ninth consecutive year. The Brewers famously have this incredible bad track record with All-Star games, because when they were an American League team, the NL won all of them, and then they flipped to the National League, and the American League has won all of them since, pretty much. So the poor Brewers have won like 18 total All-Star games since their inception in 1970. It is a very tough scene. Not Devin Williams' fault, though. He had a great game. Good stuff from him.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, in my lifetime, I can remember only watching a couple of All-Star games the National League or the Brewers side won. It's a pretty remarkable streak there they've got going on. So good job, National League. I'll carry on with Friday night's game. Before the heroics by Luis Urias were the heroics by the Raptor, Brent Suter. 12 pitches, 2 innings, 6 outs, no runs allowed despite the Manfred man starting on second base. Just really an incredible effort. You feel like in those spots, if a guy can just give up one run, he's done his job. And, you know, you bring in a guy like Suter, who gets some strikeouts, but he's going to get his outs by putting the ball in play and getting weak contact. You really are banking on just, okay, leave it at one run and we'll try to scratch across one. So to put up two was just, I mean, really one of the best extra inning efforts, probably the best extra inning effort in the Manfred man era for the Brewers.
Yeah, I think that's going to be one of the 10 best pitching performances, single game pitching performances of the year when we look back at the season. I mean, that's some serious yeoman's work. And quite honestly, the Brewers should not have won that game. There was a terrible call at third base on replay in which the Brewers were able to get a fielder's choice out. Willie Adames made a bad throw that should have cost them. It should have been corners with nobody out instead of a runner at first with one out. that helped the Brewers survive that that 13-inning spectacle. But they got the call, and then they did the job from there. Brent Suter, really some great stuff. My next one, Jackson Chourio is coming to Wisconsin, baby. He got the promotion from A Class A Carolina to Advanced Class A Wisconsin, the Timber Rattlers. He is going to be in a Timber Rattlers uniform on Tuesday night. Who wants to go to Appleton to see the top prospect in the Brewers organization play? We knew this was going to happen at some point, probably soon. Here it is. He's only 18 years old, 9 months younger. 9 months younger than the next oldest player at the entire level that he's going to be playing at. That's wild. But again, this is a guy Brewers fans dreaming huge on, and he's going to be a draw, man. This is a high level. I mean, we've crossed over from prospect to this is a guy people actually pay to go see at Appleton. So very exciting moment, and I'm sure we're going to be seeing a lot more of him.
I would think it would be a sellout in Appleton on Tuesday night, which is interesting because the Brewers will have a home game. But I would venture to guess, you know, if you're a Brewers fan and you're picking between the two games, you might go up to Appleton to see Chourio. I don't know. I feel like that's kind of what I would lean.
I'm going to say no. I'm going to say it's not a sellout. No, okay. That's too much. Too much. But I don't know. I could be wrong.
We'll see. I think you will be wrong. I'm gonna go a little off the beaten path here. We're gonna go with a listener tweet at us. Send us some tweets, by the way, with your thoughts on the pod. We always appreciate those. We got one today, JR, that said that we look opposite how we sound. Our voices don't match our faces. We both sound like the other looks. So I don't know what that means, but I guess I look like a 40-year-old guy with no hair. And congratulations, you are in your 20s still.
I look very young, and I'm 6'6". And I'd love to know how the person who tweeted at us feels about after this particular episode of the podcast with my voice doing what it is currently doing. All I can say, I mean, I do have a higher register voice, Kurt. So, and you're deeper than me. So I could see why somebody feels that way, because maybe my voice is the more baby face sounding. I don't know.
Yeah, I definitely don't have the radio voice. I don't know what exactly this voice is. I'm not
ruling that out. I'm not ruling out radio voice on you.
I mean, I like to do me some radio hits, but I don't think, I don't know. I just don't have it. I just don't have it. Although the faces, those are for radio.
Yeah, I think my face is fabulous, so I could do TV, maybe not. So thanks for the feedback. We'll take it. Again, apologies on what you got out of the voices on this particular episode of the podcast. But yeah, I don't know what to make of it either. I'll be thinking about that. That's very funny. My third thing for three up, three down, Jake McGee, the Giants left-handed reliever who was waived. The Brewers sign him to a one-year deal this week. So they do add to their bullpen. There's still a couple guys in the bullpen that have struggled, who I don't know are going to be on this roster for much longer. So we've kind of reached the point of the season where they're going to try to find some guys, whether that be through the trade deadline or through a pickup like Jake McGee. McGee has had a ton of success, namely the last 2 years. He was very, very good. This year, not so much. So they're kind of banking that they could figure out what that thing is that gave him success the last couple of years. And he's already pitched in the game. He got through it. I could see this guy working out. You know, he's the type of veteran guy that the Brewers occasionally will bring in, you know, not Drew Pomeranz level, because I don't think you could expect to reach that level, but like that type of guy who shows up and winds up being a really big contributor, especially as a left-hander. So that's a new addition to the team this week, and we will see again. That trade deadline is right around the corner. There's more to come.
Yeah, there's been some tinkering going on with Jake McGee, which will be interesting to see if that leads to anything. That was what, you know, turned him into a good pitcher when going from Colorado to LA. So that'll be something to watch if he can work himself into a bigger bullpen role. For my third thing to cap this off, Brandon Woodruff is back. Oh, I think we talked about him a little bit, you know, in past pods, but he's looking, you know, like Brandon Woodruff once again. His mechanics are in order, and he's, you know, blowing both fastballs by guys, mixing in some of the off speed, and he's got, I believe, a 2.20 ERA in 5 starts since coming back. Was really good again Saturday night, 1 run, 8 strikeouts over 6 innings. And I said this to you earlier today, his FIP, his fielding independent pitching, actually better than Corbin Burns. And I don't love FIP. It's not a fantastic stat, but it tells you that, you know, between home runs and strikeouts and walks, he's been better than Corbin Burns.
Now imagine what that rotation looks like if they get Freddy Peralta back. It's going to be great. It's going to be really good stuff. So yes, Brandon Woodruff looking good again. All right, let's go back in time. Not very far this week for Remember When. I was thinking about 2018 because, the Brewers were playing the Rockies, and two of the guys who appeared in that series were Antonio Senzatella, who pitched in the 2018 divisional series between the Brewers and Rockies, and Yoli Chacin, who pitched in that series for the Milwaukee Brewers. He was part of that shutout in Game 2, that 4-0 shutout, worked five innings in that game. Chacin, of course, is the guy who pitched Game 163 against the Cubs. He was very, very important to the team that year, kind of came out of nowhere to be a very good contributor against his old team, the Rockies, and now his new team, his current team. He went back to Colorado. But I went back and looked at that first game of the series, and part of that was Charlie Blackman had a pretty good series for the Rockies, and I still find myself thinking about the foul ball he hit that easily could have put the Rockies in front in that first game, that game one of the series, and could have changed the whole complexion of things. I don't know how much you think about that, but I went back and watched some of the highlights from the game. There's a lot of things I don't remember. There's Ryan Braun trying to score from second base on a wild pitch.
Yep. I do remember that one. Not much else, but that one I definitely do.
Yeah, so he gets thrown out. That ends the first. Yelich, I think a lot of people remember, he had a home run to make it 2-0 in the third inning. Place was going nuts. Miller Park then, I can say that safely. It was Miller Park, and place was up for grabs. Orlando Arcia made an incredible play in the sixth inning, and also an incredible tag to catch a runner stealing. Manny Pena threw out two guys trying to steal second base, and Orlando Arcia was very, very flashy in that game. Josh Hader came in and got four outs, but then things kind of go sideways in the ninth. Jeremy Jeffress pitching, first two guys reach. Charlie Blackman, he had hit this ball down the right field line that was just foul, and if it goes fair, two runs score and Charlie Blackman is on second base. Now, as it happened, Charlie Blackman still singled, and both of those runners that were on base still came around to score, but if that had happened, Charlie Blackman would have ended up much, much further along on the base paths. He wouldn't have been on third when he ended up getting caught in a rundown on a ball that was hit, I think, right to first base. So that ends up paying off. The Brewers end up getting out of that inning with a tie against Jeremy Jeffress, and they end up winning that game in extras, as many people remember, on the Mike Moustakas walk-off. Gerardo Parra very nearly won the game for the Rockies against Joaquin Soria, or it wouldn't have been a winner, but it would have been a go-ahead shot in the 10th, but it was caught at the wall by Yelich. I didn't remember that. And then Adibat Avino comes in, he walks Yelich, throws a wild pitch, that puts Yelich at second base, and then Moustakas, what I also remember about that at-bat is he went down 0-2 to Adivino, and then a third pitch that he just barely gets a piece of, and catcher Tony Walters has it hit his glove twice, almost gets the glover on that ball for what would have been strike three. It would have ended the inning. Instead, he gets one more pitch, singles into right field. Everyone knows what happens after that. Place goes nuts. They win the game. They win the second game in shutout fashion. Jeremy Jeffress works two innings for that one to get the save in game two. They go to Colorado. They win, and they move on to face the Dodgers. Kyle Freeland, their best pitcher that year, never got into a game, which blows my mind still. He had gotten into the wild card game, that was a wild card game against the Cubs, to even get Colorado to that place. So he wasn't on a lot of rest or anything, but still, I'm really surprised they didn't find a spot for him. It just did not happen, and the Brewers won that series. So it's a short trip into memory lane, but something, a series that a lot of people, I think, remember fondly. The only series that the Brewers have won in the postseason here in this 4-year window of making the playoffs 4 years in a row. All right, Kurt, let's wrap it up with our take of the week. It's your Kurt Blanche.
Ryan Braun sends it to left center and deep. Get up! Get out of here! Gone for Ryan Braun! He just hit a walk-off
home. All right, I'm gonna come at you here from a lower arm slot angle. From the left side, in middle relief. my name is Hobie Milner, and I think I deserve more high leverage opportunities out of the Brewers bullpen. We've talked about him as sort of one of the underrated MVPs of the season, and I think he very much has been. Had a 1.91 ERA coming into today, and lowered that today, although today's game is largely the reason why I'm bringing this up. And despite not pitching in the strike zone really at all, he's getting lots of chase and very confident in his stuff and excelling. You know, he's He's not walking guys. He's getting strikeouts, getting weak contact. He's had an excellent year. And so I was a bit perplexed today when in the sixth inning, after John DelGustave got out of the fifth inning that Eric Lauer could not finish, he was back out there for the sixth. Now, I get it. You know, he's got a bunch of right-handed batters coming up for the Rockies, and he's a power pitcher with a power sinker. Theoretically, a good matchup, but it seemed pretty clear early on that he did not have it, and they did not, you know, go to even get Hobie Milner up until kind of late in that inning, and then they ended up going down, and Hobie Milner comes in, gets one strikeout, gets out of the inning, and then the Brewers tie it in the bottom half. And then Hobie Milner's gone. No more Hobie Milner in the game. They went with Brad Boxberger, who has, by and large, been very good. But some of the under the hood peripheral stuff is not quite there. And his outings of late have not been as good, especially as Hobie, who has been on a tear basically since, what, the beginning of March. So it was curious to me that, kind of with how it all played out, Gustave got eight hitters. Boxberger got what, six or seven or whatever, you know, it ended up being in his inning, giving up two runs. And although, you know, granted, you want the Brewers ideally would have just had him face three, but nevertheless, Milner gets one, and sort of the higher leverage spots there went to other guys. So just going to put it out there. Hobie Milner should be the seventh inning guy. That's it.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it, because point blank, you look at the stats, he's their best reliever behind the obvious guys, Josh Hader and Devin Williams. He is the best reliever after that. So I agree with you. Where's the leverage for this guy? And over time, I think lefties have been treated with kid gloves more than their counterparts, because they typically are there just to get lefties out. That's it. But with the three batter minimum, I would think that we're over that. That's an era gone by where you just got to be a pitcher, and he can get right-handers out. The stats say that too. So I'm really surprised that we haven't seen more out of him in those spots as well. I think we probably will. Brad Boxberger is really struggling, so I think you're probably going to see his name a little bit in those spots as well. But yeah, maybe it wasn't Sunday, but the time is coming for Hobie Milner. If he keeps this up, it's undeniable they're going to have to use him in some pretty big spots.
Yeah, that's where we're at.
All right, that's going to do it for the current stuff for this voice. Thank God you're thinking to yourself, because we're going to move now to my interviews. A couple good ones. Ricky Weeks, Brewers, we'll start there. He's, of course, the former Brewers second baseman. Talked to him about some Brewers memories, some good stuff, some memories you'll remember, of course. Prince Fielder is coming back for the Walk of Fame, so I really wanted to ask him about that and his time with Prince. They came up together through the minor leagues and were great friends, still great friends. They both live in Florida, so that's something that spent a lot of time on, and I really enjoyed chatting with him. And then after that, we've got Stephen Watson, Bally Sports Wisconsin, the newest face on Bally Sports Wisconsin on the post-game, pre-game shows, formerly of WISN, so got a little background on him and his journey. He's a Philadelphia guy. There's a Philly sports story that Packers and, you know, Bucks fans may not like, but you'll have to brace yourself for that and just enjoy it. So thanks for listening. Hear those interviews back-to-back, and we'll catch you again next week. Thank you, Kurt. See you later.
See ya.
My guest is Ricky Weeks, former Brewers second baseman, spent a decade with the organization, a little more than a decade, and he is now back with the Milwaukee Brewers, working in an interesting capacity. That's actually where I first want to start. Thanks for joining me, Ricky, and first of all, I want kind of to know what it is you are doing now. I know you're working in the organization. Can you kind of give me the rundown of what they got you doing these days?
You know, kind of doing, a split version of baseball operations and player development. So, found out some great guys in Eduardo Pizzuello, Matt Klein, and obviously the head honcho, David Stern. So for me to come in here, just to lend a hand, and hopefully speak up when I need to be, and to go out and just help the organization any way I can. And for the most part, really, I'm just glad to be back inside the organization. Obviously, that's where I started out at. But for me, it comes full circle. So, you just want to have the opportunity to see the end one time, and that's why I'm back.
So your day-to-day, I think you live in Arizona. You can correct me if I'm wrong now. So do you spend most of your time in Arizona, or do you go to Biloxi and various other places?
Right. No, I'm still in Florida.
Oh, you are in Florida
kind of travel. Yeah. Cool. I'm still in Florida. I'm not going nowhere, hopefully, right now. So, but for me, no, it's just a lot of traveling. I'm probably out one time a month, probably for 2 weeks. Going through the various levels, obviously with the big league teams, certain stops, things like that. But for me, and trying to learn the ropes, I guess on the other side of the table now. So, getting experience there, and, there's some things that I do know, and there's some things that I learned. So I think with any job or any kind of profession, I think that's one of the things that you have to learn and kind of go through.
So there's a couple reasons why I want to talk to you. The draft, we're in draft season, and you have one of the more unique draft stories, I think, in Brewers history, just by virtue of where you were picked. And then also wanted to talk a lot about Prince Fielder, who's coming back to be honored by the Walk of Fame. I know that you guys are still close, is my understanding. So I wanted to reminisce a little bit. Starting with the draft, Brewers fans will remember it was kind of a Delman Young or Ricky Weeks situation where the Tampa Bay Rays is going to take one or the other. They take Delman with the first overall pick. You come in at number two. I'm curious just what that meant as you look back on it now in total, what that meant to be the number two overall pick, because it seems like there'd be a lot of baggage that comes with it. I feel like it's a type of thing that follows around a player, whether or not they have a ton of success. And you obviously had a ton of success, but you also heard people who would bemoan the fact that the number two pick should be a super superstar, and it feels a little unfair, but it also sets you up, I would imagine, for success. So like, how do you look at that, and how do you think about the draft when you're asked to reminisce about it?
It's a great experience. I was the first in my family to get to that point to where I was able to, provide my family, at the time, a sense of stability. Regardless of that point, I guess the other fact that you had brought up, whether or not you define success, whether being number two or anything like that. But for me, I really don't really think about that. I think, when you're in a situation where you're put in a position to play the game that you love at the highest level and to do some things that a lot of people haven't gotten a chance to do, I think that's a success in itself. Now, the only downturn was that was not 2011, not getting to the World Series and winning it, but other than that, that's the end goal that you always want to get to in professional sports.
You got to do something that I don't know if we'll see again. The way that the rules are set up now, you don't have guys getting offered major league contracts out of the draft, and you don't have the same September roster rules. So in 2003, the year you're drafted, you get to play in September with the Brewers. I'm curious how you think about that experience. Did that give you confidence? Did it? What was that experience like as a freshly drafted guy out of Southern, suddenly playing in the big leagues that September?
That was crazy. For me, going into this whole situation was I've always been a very open minded person. So for me going in, I had no ceiling of what it should look like or what it what I want it to look like. But for me coming in there, just working hard, putting my head down and trying to work and play, and then you finally get that call, obviously, to go up and same year and bright eyed and seeing guys that you've seen on TV before. I never forget my first start was against, I think, the Houston Astros, and seeing Jeff Bagwell, Biggio, I'm facing Billy Wagner on the mound. So these guys that you play, you grew up playing video games with or against, what I'm saying? So for me, that whole first year was it's a blast from the past, I guess you could say, and going out there and living your dream.
So you and Prince both from the state of Florida originally, correct? You're from Florida originally, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So did you know him before you guys were part of the same organization? Had you met him on the high school circuit or anything like that? I mean, I know you're a couple years older than him, but did you have a previous relationship?
Yeah. So that's where that's kind of where it all started. I know me and him played Chelimon baseball, which was a tribal ball organization here in Orlando, which is pretty prominent. So me and him played on that team together for about a year and a half. We had that, the common bond anyway. And then I remember getting drafted. I really didn't know who was in the organization. I was just happy to get drafted. And then going on a roster, I remember picking up the roster and seeing who's on the team and seeing Prince and Tony Gwynn, who I actually did prior year before that. Me and him, we crossed paths at Team USA trial. So seeing those guys right there, it was immediate, friendship and immediate, there's a special bond there, there was a special bond.
Yeah, Gwynn taken in the round right after you. So I know that you guys were kind of together kind of along the whole minor league path. Do you have any good stories for any of those guys coming up through the minor leagues that you'd be willing to share, I guess, is always
right,
the caveat.
Right, exactly. Well, that's the key part. That's the key part. But no, I think, the I shouldn't say a story, but I think our whole journey, I think throughout the whole process, I think getting to the big leagues and him going on and having a great success, obviously, man, with us and the afterlife of the Brewers, I guess you could say. It was just a process of like, man, I genuinely want to work hard and we want to see if, you know, each other succeed. I think, you know, that's kind of hard to find in the common pro sports sometimes. I'm not saying that's not there, but, you know, it's hard to find that. But I think, you know, the way we push each other, the way we kind of police each other, I kind of think that kind of set the tone for a lot of other guys, maybe possibly, hopefully. And, you know, that's what we try to present.
How would you describe him personality-wise? Because we saw a lot of sides of him at the big league level, and it seems like, you know, everyone who knows him talks so highly of him. What kind of person was he coming up through the ranks?
Oh, great. I mean, great. You know, I think the biggest thing, you know, that you get from it is, you know, a guy like Prince and the superstar S, aura so was around him. He was still very humble. And I think that's the biggest thing that I kind of admire from him, man, to be in this position that he was in. And obviously, man, to find him by his father, which is a big deal too. So kind of all that kind of the culmination of a guy who is, man, good to be around, man, a great teammate to be around, obviously, and just a good human being, period.
All right, so I want to go over a couple moments that prominently star both you and him, and the obvious one is right at the beginning in June. I think it's June 25th, 2005. You guys are playing the Minnesota Twins at Miller Park, and you lead off the game with your first career home run. Prince Fielder hits his first career home run later in the game, the go-ahead shot. That's a wild memory for me. One of my favorite Brewers memories coming up the ranks, because the Brewers are not they hadn't had a 500 season in forever at that point.
Right, I remember.
And yes, I'm sure you do. And you guys, this wave of prospects coming through, and it kind of just culminates against Johan Santana. How often does that pop up in the memory bank for you? And I guess what do you think of when you think about that day?
No, guys come up quite often, actually. Sometimes through social media now and post from that certain day in Major League Baseball, whatever the case may be. But for me, the biggest thing came from it was, like, you know, we finally arrived. That was our final arrival to Major League Baseball, to the Milwaukee Brewers. I think the first wave of guys coming in, I think that kind of, you know, that felt good for me. I'm sure it felt good for Prince as well. But, you know, Major League Baseball, you know, you only get that first one out the way. And I think that kind of led to a lot more. But I think the biggest thing for me was just, and getting that one out the way, and against who it was against, and against the team who it was against. And I mean, it was just a joy to have that day as well.
I wonder how many people hit their first career home run against the reigning Cy Young Award winner. There's probably a few, but that's a heck of a thing, man. I would talk about that all the time. You know, I hit my first career home run against Johan Santana, who won the Cy Young.
Right.
That's pretty sweet.
I won't get out far, but I try to edge it out a little bit. You know, you try to sometimes.
Of course. Okay, so one in 2009 that I wanted to ask you about. I don't know if we call it the bowling ball celebration or the bomb celebration, but it's a walk-off home run for Prince against the Giants. Very memorable celebration, not necessarily in terms of stakes, but in terms of the choreographed celebration at the end. What do you remember about that? I've asked Craig Counsell about it. My sort of understanding is that maybe Craig Counsell had a little bit more to do with it than he leads on in terms of the genesis of the idea, even though it seems like Prince was kind of the driving force. So how did that all come together?
No, and by the way, Counsell had to be dragged down
by you
in the pile just to, yes, exactly. I had to drag him down, but no, it all started, you know, the back of the bus. You know, it was a road trip I think we had, and either going to the airport or coming from the airport, we're back in the bus. I think we kind of, you know, man, we need like a walk-off celebration. We need to do some stuff. And I think after that, I think we had a couple more where we ran down the tunnel. We just didn't show up for interviews on purpose and things like, you know, just to have that team bonding thing. But I kind of showed up. It started on the bus through conversation. And we just, hey, man, next one, you know, this is what we're going to do. And obviously Prince got it. The very next spring training got plucked in the back by Barry Zito. Because I don't think the Giants like that one too much.
I can't imagine holding a grudge that long. That is quite the time.
Yeah, I know, exactly. You know, I'll stop right there.
Yeah. Oh man, we've said plenty on the behalf of the Brewers. Like, that's really incredible, weirdly incredible. Okay, then there's last thing I wanted to ask you about 2011, the Home Run Derby. Just you going to the All-Star Game in general, getting a chance to start, and then there's this famous situation where Prince Fielder is the captain of the Home Run Derby team. He gets to pick his people. He picks you over Justin Upton, which comes up in the it comes up all season long. But then, of course, you play the Diamondbacks in the postseason that year. That's wild. I don't know how you felt about that at the time. If you thought, you know what, just pick Justin Upton or whatever, or you know, like, hey, I want to do it. So let's absolutely pick me. What do you remember about all that?
It was crazy because I mean, I've never done home derby before. Obviously, my first All Star game, but Prince asked me, I said, of course I will. You know, yeah. And I go out there. I didn't think none of it. And I remember, I don't know if some came on the media or something like that. And then you started hearing rumblings about, you know, because it was Arizona to pick Justin Upton and things like that or whatever. I had no clue. Then I show up to the home run derby. I'm getting booed the whole time by all the fans. It was bittersweet, you know what I'm saying? You know, bittersweet. But, I mean, it still felt good to be there. I think my pride of that whole situation was, I think we started in Arizona that very next, our first games were in Arizona or shortly after that. And I'll never forget the first time I get up there and I hit a home run, you know, through all the boos and stuff like that. So that was, kind of cool.
I was going to ask you about your most revered home runs, because I knew you didn't have any walk-off home runs with the Brewers. And then I looked, and unless I'm wrong, I don't think you had one in your career, which is crazy to me, a walk-off home run. I know those are random, but I didn't know which ones in particular stuck out to you. There's a couple in my head that I think I would definitely think are on your short list, but what makes your short list of the Ricky Weeks highlight reel, home run highlight reel?
Oh gosh, that's, I don't know about that one. That's tough.
Well, let me give you the
so one.
Oh, you go ahead.
Go ahead.
The ones that jump to mind are you're the very first batter of the 2011 season in Cincinnati, and you hit the home run. It was back to back to start, I think, with Gomez. That ends up being a loss for the Brewers, but that's a very memorable season. That's fun. And then there's another one that I remember vividly, hit off the windows on the third deck of the Brewers. I don't remember what it was called, the Gale Club at one time. I don't even know what it was called, the 300 Club or whatever. Yeah. Absolute bomb, just like jaw dropping bomb. Those are a couple that stick out to me, but I don't know. You may have others.
No, I had a couple homers. I know one that kind of stands out now. Those were two great home runs too, by the way. But one that stood out. I remember that we had a meeting either the day before or that same day as far as protection for Prince in a lineup, and I was kind of the odd one who hit leadoff, who had some juice or whatever the case may be, some pop, and you know, kind of. I had to mix it up, so they kind of put it behind Prince. I remember going out and hitting, the go-ahead in the bottom of the eighth, the top of the ninth home run in Colorado to beat them. So that kind of stood out as well.
Do you still, going back to the All-Star game, do you have any memorabilia from that 2011 season or from the All-Star game in particular? But that was such a memorable season for Brewers fans overall. You got any stuff still in your Florida home from that?
Oh yes, I got a whole PlayStation still in bubble wrap downstairs. So,
oh wow!
I got a PlayStation from the All-Star game. I got some, of course, I got some shirts and some gold baseballs from the home run derby. My son still hits around the house right now, so and I got to watch him now. But for the most part, man, I got a bunch of stuff from that year.
I can't believe you haven't unwrapped the PlayStation at any point.
No, so I am I guess a fake gamer. A fake gamer, so I might play some FIFA, I might play some Madden every now and then. But sure. And for the most, so I have all the systems, and to put it that way. And I got kids now, so you know they play those systems now. But I had the old PlayStation; I already had one already, so I kept it there. I said one day maybe I'll put it up somewhere, saying that I got this from the All-Star game. Who knows? I don't know.
Your kids aren't enough into the gaming nostalgia part of it to want a system from 11 years ago, is what you're saying. They're good with what they've
got. Of course not. Of course. Yeah, they're very good. Trust me.
All right. So a couple more. The bat waggle that you had in your batting stance. Gary Sheffield is the name that everybody comes up with when they talk about it, when they think about it. Was that an influence, or did that just come about sort of naturally, or just through some process that had nothing to do with any, trying to duplicate what anybody had done before?
Right. So I've had that question a lot, actually. And actually, man, when I grew up, I used to want to bat like, and Ricky Henderson, he's my favorite player. Gary Sheffield, around the time, he's from Central Florida area. So, ever since growing up, my father kind of gravitated toward guys in my who's in my area. So I had a whole bunch of batting stances, but in the Double A that year, I think us collective guys as a group, we struggled the first year. They kind of skipped us a a league up, to kind of, speed the process up or whatever, I guess, and going through the struggles of the first half, trying to find rhythm and things like that. And I remember going back to, as a kid, just getting the batter's box and feel like yourself. And I started touring around some things that felt like myself, and there it was. That's how it kind of stuck.
You're a guy who famously stood close to the plate. So I got a trivia question for you. Do you have more career home runs or hit by pitches? Do you know?
That's close. I honestly don't know. it's that close, I think.
It's home runs, and it's by like 20. I think it's like 161 to 134. So you're safely in the home run.
Okay. I knew it was something like that. I'm always wanting to say hit by pitches at first.
There were a lot of them. I don't know. You still have any battle scars from that? Any of them that really got you?
Oh, no. It's one of those things, man. Once you get hit by a pitch, especially if you stand that close to the plate, you need to kind of have that kind of that quote unquote tough man mentality, I guess. Yeah. And, it doesn't hurt then, but it hurts the very next day, though.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. So are you going to get a chance to come back? I know you were back for the Wall of Honor. When you went in with Trevor Hoffman and JJ Hardy, are you going to be back for a Prince's Walk of Fame thing as well?
I'm not sure, because I know we have some work stuff to do. Some business stuff to do. So I got to see how the schedule kind of plans out. But I would love to be there. But I know that's a special moment for anybody going in, man. And let it on Prince. So I wish everybody the best with that, because I know when I went to my Wall of Honor, that's pretty special for me.
Yeah, and last question: when you interact with Brewers fans now, do you still get a chance to chat with fans? What do they say to you?
Here in Orlando, Florida, actually, I was stopped the other day at Publix at the grocery store, so it was kind of a oh, okay, and they're from Wisconsin, so it's just one of those things where it feels good. Do I get a chance to really chat with them too much? No, I don't. I know the busy of life and work and things like that or whatever, you don't really get a chance to really talk to fans and privacy too is at the same time too. But I've always loved the fact to interact. I just met a couple the other day, took them to the game or sent them to the game in Temple and the Brewers in town. So that was cool to help out some guys who liked us, at the time that, when they were growing up in Wisconsin themselves. So, and to be able to do stuff like that, it brings a smile on my face.
All right, sir. I really appreciate the time. Thank you so much. And hopefully we see you at, an American Family Field sometime soon.
I'm sure we will. Appreciate you.
My guest is Stephen Watson. You may have seen him at WISN when he was a longtime Milwaukee sports personality, so sports broadcaster. What's the terminology? What's the term I should use for that, Steve?
Sports broadcaster works.
Yeah, I like it. I like it.
I held many hats, but I think broadcaster is kind of the umbrella term there.
I like it. I don't always like it when people call me journalist, because I feel like that should be reserved for the people who are like boots on the ground doing the serious work. You are a boots on the ground reporter, so like I feel like that fits you just fine. But
I don't know. We kind of play in the playpen in sports a little bit. I kind of feel the same way as you. I'm not doing too much down and dirty.
No, it's true. It's true. It's a lot of fun. Now, though, if people want to see you, they see you on their TVs before and after Brewers games, part of the Bally Sports Wisconsin team. New member of the team, making the switch, and I wanted to bring you on and chat a little bit about it, about your new role and kind of what you expect Bally to look like going forward, things along that nature. But first of all, I told you this was going to be my first question. And you have to be honest. Are you Stephen Watson?
I really thought you were joking.
Absolutely not. I am not joking.
We're jumping in here.
Are you the best dressed personality in Milwaukee, media? I'm just going to go Milwaukee media at large, not even sports. Are you best dressed? And you have to be honest.
Oh, man. That JR, that's tough, man. Like, I love clothes. I take a lot of pride in wearing fun outfits. I don't know. We got some pretty good dressers for the most part in the city.
Very diplomatic.
I kind of live by the motto: dress for the job you want, not the one you have. But my grandfather was a very loud dresser, and he was my best friend growing up. Like, we talked every day on the phone, and I loved his style. He just had so much fun with it, and I feel like I kind of took that on from him. And there's no sport coat that's too loud. I'm not like Don Cherry. Like, I'm not like rocking like wild, wild outfits. But you got to have a little fun with it, because when you're on TV, you don't want to look exactly like everybody else. So in a long-winded answer, I like to think I'm near the top of the list. I don't like to talk about myself like that, but I do put a lot of thought and have a lot of fun with the clothes that I wear.
You're a big golf guy, and the suit that always sticks out to me is the red one. I don't know if you have like six of those or whatever, but is that a Tiger knot? Are you a Tiger Woods fan? I don't even know.
Are you talking about the one in my Twitter profile picture?
Absolutely. That's the one.
Yeah, I bought that. That was a splurge purchase. I bought that on my honeymoon in Italy with my wife. I looked at that and I was like, I don't want that. I need that. And it's actually kind of funny that you bring up that sport coat, because I kind of think of it as like my big game sport coat. Like, I'm only saving that for the big games and moments. And I've actually only worn it twice to cover a sporting event. It was the Rose Bowl, which is where I debuted it. That's where that Twitter profile picture is from. They lost that, of course. And then it was game one of the NBA Finals. I wore it in Phoenix, and they lost that game. So
I
think I've retired it from wearing for big games, because it's clearly not bringing me much luck. But I've worn it a couple times in studio, a couple of interviews. But yeah, that's definitely my favorite piece of wardrobe I have in the closet.
Yes, I do appreciate the tailored look, Stephen Watson. You are from Philadelphia, so yeah. I want to get just kind of your origin story, so to speak, and how you arrived, how you got to Milwaukee, and you know, I guess ultimately why you decided to stay as long as you have in Milwaukee.
Yeah, I think a lot of people in our business have, you know, taken the scenic route to get to where they are, and mine is a little unconventional. I am born and raised right outside of Philadelphia. My family, for the most part, still lives there. My parents are in the same house that I was at growing up. My sister and her husband live in downtown. My brother lives in Boston, is moving to Pittsburgh, but you know, he lived in Philadelphia for most of his life. I did not want to go to Penn State, but I wanted to go to a big school. I actually really wanted to go to Michigan. And my grandmother on my dad's side went to Wisconsin. It was the last school I applied to of 12. And because I just heard like, oh, this is this really cool school. It's supposed to have a beautiful campus and a really good journalism program. I've known that I wanted to get into this industry since I was in high school. I started the sports broadcasting club at my high school with my two best friends who are both still in the business as well, which is really fun. And I wanted to go to a big school that would give me opportunities to cover big games and have a good journalism program. So I didn't get into Michigan, is part of like why I resent that school to this day. But it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I got deferred until I had to give an answer for, it was Penn State, Maryland, or Wisconsin. And my mom and I, I'll never forget, we visited Madison in like middle of April. We had to make our decision by May 1st for where I was going to go. And we got one of those rare, amazing spring, beautiful days in Wisconsin. And we sat out on the terrace, had lunch, and I was like, this is it. And so I went to Madison, and I have spent most of my adult life now here in the state of Wisconsin, which is pretty wild to think about. I'll give you a quick resume rundown. So I graduated from Wisconsin in 2011, and knew I wanted to be on air, did a lot of stuff on air in college. And that was my passion. And I moved to Bismarck, North Dakota for my first on-air job at a regional sports network covering all high school sports. I did 100 games of play-by-play in 200 days, traveling all throughout rural North Dakota, calling five different sports and high school sports. A lot of people think that's crazy, but it's the best thing I ever did for my career, because anybody that starts off in small markets knows that it's some of the most important hours you'll ever put in, because you need to go somewhere and screw up a bunch for a really small audience and learn trial by fire. And so I was in Bismarck for 1 year, and then I loved the TV aspect of it. So I got into local news and went to Burlington, Vermont, and was there for just over 2 years as a weekend sports anchor there. And the same parent company that owned the station in Burlington, Vermont, owns WISN Channel 12 in Milwaukee. Cool. And I made the jump, and it was a great way to come back to a state that I knew, to cover my alma mater and then all pro teams. And that was November of 2014. And I expected to be here for one TV contract, and the goal was always to get back to Philly. And as I said on my last day at WISN a couple of weeks ago, Milwaukee has this unbelievable way of opening its arms, grabbing you and holding you close. And it's become home for me and my growing family. So we absolutely love it here.
Yeah, you and I have met, I think first met probably covering prep events around Milwaukee, you know, when you were at WISN. So I have a deep affinity for high school sports coverage. I'm sure you do too. I know other people who've gone to North Dakota to sort of get their path started. And then Vermont. I don't know. I'm trying to think of two more disparate places on the map. Well, maybe, no, they're both cold. So they both probably are.
Yeah, I've only done the cold route. I haven't done the hot city yet. I wonder why sometimes, but.
Do you have a formative Philly sports moment that sticks out to you that really resonates, made you become a sports fan?
Oh man, you're setting me up here. This is
yes, I am.
Listening off.
You're going back to 2001. I bet you are.
I was at the game seven in 2001.
And then I mean, 2003.
I grew up with AI, man. Like, that was my childhood. He made me fall in love with the game of basketball. And I was also at 4th and 26.
Yeah, you were. That's where I was going. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget. My dad wanted to leave because he works really hard. He works really early. He's a doctor, and he wanted to beat the traffic to get home. And I was like, Dad, just one more play. Sure enough, that was when Favre dropped back and threw that great pass to Brian Dawkins, I believe it was. And then from there is kind of where the wheels fell off for the Packers. And yeah, I'll never forget where I was when Freddie Mitchell caught that ball over the middle on 4th and 26.
That is something you have in common with many, many Packers fans. They will never forget where they were. I said 03, that's early 04 after the 03 season. But man, that's that hurts. How did you win over the hearts of Milwaukee, even though you were on the other side of the 4th and 26 phenomenon?
I think being a Badger helps.
There you go. That's true.
I am a very proud Badger, I will say. I don't bring up and rub in the face of Packer fans like 4th and 26, because until 2018, I really had nothing to brag about as an Eagles fan. Like, right. There were some pretty dark Kevin Cobb, you know, Michael Vick. Yeah, I don't even know. The list goes on and on of guys they tried to make work in Philly. Sure enough, it took Nick Foles as a backup quarterback to make our dreams a reality. But
of course, who didn't see that coming?
It's definitely not the way I like to introduce myself to people here in this state, with how passionate they are with Packers fans. Hi, I'm Steven. I was at 4th and 26. Go Bears.
The Packers got some vengeance there while you were in college and the run.
Yeah,
I
was at the Riley Cooper game too, where I think, was that Tremont or was that Al? Who had the interception in the corner of the end?
Yep,
Tremont. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was at that game as an Eagles fan. So Packers have had quite a run. I thought they'd have another ring since I've been in this market. I bet, honestly, now that I'm not covering the Packers anymore, like, Packers fans are really excited about that, because I was 0-4 in NFC championship games I attended and covered.
Oh, man.
So maybe they'll finally get it right now that I'm done covering the team.
Obviously, this is a Brewers podcast, but since you do have sort of a wider breadth of Wisconsin sports knowledge at this point, I'll ask a question I was going to ask later. Let's go back. I remember thinking about 2011, the year that you graduate college. The Brewers, of course, 2011, they go to the NLCS. The Packers, they've just won a Super Bowl. If you had told me then that the Bucks would be the next team to win a championship of that group of three, I'd be pretty flabbergasted. I'd be blown away. What about now? Like, right now, I find that question very difficult. If I were to say, which of the three, Brewers, Packers, Bucks, who's going to win again? I guess you have to say Bucks, but like, I don't know. How would you answer that if someone posed that to you?
Yeah, it's a fun question to have posed to you, right? Because they all have a chance. And that even that thought is pretty wild for a lot of Wisconsin sports fans. And that's been honestly like the most fun part about the stretch that I've been able to witness with a front row seat over the last couple of years is really just this. There's never been a stretch like it where all the teams have been this competitive. And then you throw in events like U.S. Opens and Ryder Cups as a golf fanatic, like the opportunity to cover those events as well in the state have been incredible. I think you have to say Bucks right now. As long as they have Giannis, they have a shot. And I really do think that if Middleton didn't get injured, they were going back to the NBA Finals. I don't know if they were beating that Warriors team, but I do think that they were going to get back to the NBA Finals if he was healthy. And it looks like their core is going to be here for another couple years. So I think you have to say Bucks just because they've done it and they have the firepower. And I without Davante Adams, I just don't think the Packers are there. And the Brewers, it's still so hard to win without the big names. In Major League Baseball, I think they have great pitching, but I don't know if they have the depth to win a World Series. I hope they prove me wrong in a couple of months here.
Yeah,
but I still think that Bucks is the most likely to win another title.
Yeah, so let's talk a little more about the Brewers, but specifically, kind of, you know, your new role here. Why the change? That's the easy question. You've been at WISN for a while, and Bally's is I don't know how I would think it'd be a little more specific because it's primarily, I would think, Bucks and Brewers, but maybe that's wrong. I know you're a big golf guy, so maybe there's a more opportunities there that I didn't even realize. But why the move?
Well, first and foremost, this was always my goal. When I moved to Milwaukee, I wanted to keep moving up. I've always watched the production and the people that work at Bally and thought to myself, that's where I want to be if I'm going to be here. And I never knew on what timeline that was going to happen because it doesn't happen on your timeline ever. but kind of the stars aligned and it was an opportunity when they're competitive, to be in Milwaukee with two winning teams, to get to do something a little bit different, on a bigger platform in this industry. Like every single day I'm trying to grow and become more of a Swiss Army knife. And, you know, I hosted a show at WISN Big 12 Sports Saturday for the last year and a half to 2 years. And I loved the format of a little bit more, you know, because in local news, we're kind of handicapped by time. You know, we have sportscasts that are 2 minutes long, 2 minutes and 15 seconds at 6 p.m. And I think we got 3 minutes at 10. And it's hard to have a voice and to do things differently when there's only 30 minute newscasts and you have news and weather as well. So the goal of mine was always to get to a sports network where it's all sports all the time and to work with Bally where they're all true pros, from the talent all the way down to everybody that works behind the scenes in the truck. And the really exciting part is to continue to cover teams that I've gotten to know over the last 7+ years working. So this was always the goal. It was a dream scenario, how it all played out. And most importantly, for me, it's going to allow me to be more present and a better husband and father. I mean, my wife and I just had a baby girl 7 weeks ago. it's been a whirlwind to say the least. But with the job and, you know, the bigger platform and the more pressure that might come with doing bigger games for a larger audience does come a little bit more flexibility and creative control and the opportunity to bet on myself a little bit more. And I also have a golf show that I do on ESPN Milwaukee that I want to try and grow and continue to try and expand. As you mentioned at the top, like I'm a diehard golfer and there aren't many better states in the country to explore golf in its fullest than Wisconsin. We're so spoiled here with how many amazing properties and tournaments that we had and will continue to have over the next couple of years. So this move was right for me on so many levels, career-wise, challenge-wise, quality of life-wise, but most importantly, it was a perspective change for me and how I want to continue to be more present and the best husband and dad I can be as we jumped in with 2 feet to this whole thing. It's been the summer of change, but we're really excited about it.
So how good, I'm not a golfer, not a diehard golfer or any sort of golfer. How good are you? Like, do you have a handicap? How does that work?
I'm asking you to brag. Talk about myself a lot. I don't like doing this. I play a lot of golf. I'm a 4 handicap.
Okay. Okay.
So, I'm passionate about it. I play a lot. So if you're not familiar, like I shoot in the mid to high 70s for most rounds.
Oh, so do I. And over the first 7 holes. Absolutely.
it's a passion of mine. I love talking about it as well. It's a maddening and exhilarating sport. There's no sport quite like golf. There are some days I'll walk out there and I want to quit the game, but it always has a funny way of bringing you back. And that's what I love about the game. And out here, I mean, the courses that we have in this state, it's unbelievable. So it's like a playground here for golfers. And one of those great reasons why I love living here.
Do you envision Bally Sports Wisconsin having any presence with golf, or is it going to be for you specifically just that ESPN show and maybe anything else that sort of pops up?
I don't know what programming looks like. You know, they syndicate a lot of their national shows across all of the Bally's. They were previously Fox Sports, but then they were bought by Sinclair and now they're all Bally's. I would love to do some golf on TV in some way. Maybe I need to pitch that to my new bosses sooner than later. But I do think that there's an opportunity in this state in particular to do some fun things. And that's also one of the great things about working with Bally is I have a little bit more freedom to do some stuff, passion projects on the side as well, because I'm splitting all these games with Craig Kishon. I'm not doing a full Brewers 150 games because National takes over about 10 to 20 of them because they've become so good and people want to watch them nationally. There's YouTube games, there's Apple Plus TV games, there's Fox games. ESPN is starting to take, Brewers baseball and Sunday Night Baseball. So on those days, we no longer do pre and post. And it's the same with the Bucks too. They've become so good. They're playing on Christmas Day, they're playing on TNT, and there's a lot of exclusive games. So that opens up my schedule a little bit more, in addition to kind of splitting the calendar in half with Craig, I'm definitely trying to find other ways to fill my time. Because in local news, like you grind. And in this market in particular, when there's so many teams and so many successful teams, like it was part of the exhilarating part of working in local news was you'd wake up and every day was so different. Like I'd be up in Green Bay and then I'd be covering a Marquette media day and then I'd be at Badger football and then, Brewers day game. And, maybe it's just a light day where you're doing Brewers pregame or, and then there's overlap on both sides of Brewers going into the postseason with the start of Buck season and then start of Brewers season with the end of Buck season.
Badgers too. I mean, October's a wild time.
It's so fun. I mean, it was so fun waking up every day and doing something different, but you run at a different speed and it's tough. And that was, one of the main reasons why Bally was so appealing to me was to just really hone in on 2 teams that I know and be in Milwaukee and not have to travel as much and try and bring something a little bit new and fresh to the TV coverage. I love storytelling. I love humanizing these athletes. And I think that's something we've seen shift a lot in our business is a lot of these athletes having more of a voice and wanting to be a little bit more open about their lives and their passions and their families, whatever it may be. And that's definitely something I'm going to try and do in addition to hosting games is try to do some storytelling stuff and get the fans opportunities to learn more about these guys like you do with this podcast.
Yeah. So before I let you go, I want to go behind the curtain a little bit on how your Bally's broadcasts work, especially when they're on the road. And we're recording this right after a game that had several rain delays, which I imagine complicates what the studio people are doing.
Yeah, Craig drew the short straw. He had to do that.
So. I know.
Okay, not doing the rain delay game.
Yeah, that requires nimbleness that I imagine tests the boundaries a little bit. But obviously, you guys are at the games when they're at home, or I shouldn't say obviously. It seems like most of the time, and then there's studio work. So like, I don't even know if people realize that that's just like kind of a small studio in Brookfield. Like, can you kind of give a sense of how that works, especially when they're on the road?
Yeah, it's unique. It's a challenge. I've shadowed a bunch just to try and get my feet wet with the process. But road games are done from a small studio in Brookfield. And so we don't travel on the road. It's literally a desk and a green screen and two cameras, and it's very quiet. I'm doing my first road game. We're taping this, you know, right before the Brewers Giants series, and I'm doing my first road game from that studio. I have the whole Giants series this weekend. So they're throwing me into the fire with a West Coast road game. It'll be a late couple of nights for me in that studio in Brookfield. But it's very different because when you're at the ballpark, you have natural energy, right? Like there's fans around you for pregame. There's usually a couple of fans that hang around for postgame. You're in the environment. You can't fake that energy. But you got to still bring that energy to a tiny little studio in Brookfield with a green screen. And that's going to be, you know, one of the challenges. But it's also really nice to not have that crazy road schedule because, you know, our teammates that do it every single day, traveling city to city, it's a grind that not many people understand. I mean, they love it. That's why they do it. But it's tough to travel that much. So it's different because those games are done through a control room in Minneapolis as well. Cause we share a lot of our stuff with Valley Sports North, based in Minneapolis. And so that, like, my producer for road games is coming from a producer in Minneapolis, whereas home games, it's from a local producer here in Milwaukee. So there's a lot of differences. But, you know, the format for the most part is the same, and building the show is the same. Like, to give you an idea of what a day looks like, we'll usually always be exchanging text messages after a game. And then the morning of a game, of kind of some show ideas. You know, Sophia's usually always got an angle for Brewers, and we try to get, you know, the guys in the booth involved as well for a lot of the shows. And then the analyst I'm working with, whether that's Tim Dillard or Vinny Rutino, they're going to throw out their own ideas, and then we kind of build a show. You know, it's a fluid conversation throughout the day. The producer puts together a rundown that comes out, let's call it five, six hours before a game. And then I start scripting as much as I can, but all these shows are done without a teleprompter. It's all ad-libbed and off the cuff.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, we can script certain parts of it. You know, some parts at the top of the show, and maybe there's some video, and, but everything is off the cuff, which makes it fun. It's a little bit more conversational. Post-game shows are totally fly by the seat of your pants.
Sure.
And I mean, I'm a rookie. I've only done a couple of games. But that's fun. It's fun when you can just react. The pre-game shows definitely take a lot more production, and you want to try and make TV flow and sing and be as entertaining, and you always want the viewer to learn something. And that's where we lean on Tim and Vinny to, as former players, to really try and teach the audience something or break down something that, you know, Craig and I might not have the expertise in, but our job is to get them from point A to point B and set them up. So it's kind of it's song and dance to, you know, working together, and I'm still obviously trying to figure it out. But it is unique with the studio in Brookfield for road games, and then home games at the ballpark, which are a little bit more natural just because you're in the environment. It will be the same for Bucks. We'll be in that Brookfield studio for road games, and we're at the Fiserv Forum, the top of the 100 section, for home games. So I'm looking forward to seeing what this first series is like in San Fran.
Well, if you see a well-dressed man crushing it on the golf course, possibly holding a microphone, say hi to Stephen Watson. You may recognize him from the Valley Sports Wisconsin broadcast pre- and post-game. He's the new guy that's going to be taking you through the rest of this season and then into the Bucs season. Stephen, thanks, man. I really appreciate it. Very cool to hear to see you advance. I mean, like, we're friendly. I think people probably can gather that from the conversation, and it's really cool to see you in this spot, man. Congratulations.
I appreciate you, JR. And I have to say, I'm so excited to still be in Milwaukee. Like, this business, you don't often get to pick and choose a lot of where your future takes you. But I'm really happy to be here. My wife is from, you know, Whitefish Bay, and like, she's thrilled to be here still. And we're going to grow our little family here in Milwaukee. And we can't wait for hopefully a couple more successful seasons of a run from both of these teams in our future. And happy to hop back on, and whenever you want, JR. I appreciate
Sounds
you
good.
And love the podcast, and looking forward to much more.